And well, there's one thing that I read, Laverham was interesting, obviously, and that there's a whole book written about it from the point of view. It's a film entirely about eyes.
Mm.
It's about looking, and that when Roy kills Tyrell, he does it by pushing his eyes through, and obviously the guy who makes eyes is the guy that goes to see, rather than any other part. And Tyrell has these absurdly large glasses and stuff. And so is that the idea?
And also the machine.
The machine.
Tested by the eye.
It is, and it looks like a little eyeball. But it's that that idea that the being looked at and the looking and that kind of you said who is the subject, and it's like what is the subject, where is the subject, and all these things keep coming up. And it reminded me of To Take a Leap, and I've loved the talk because of the way you've kind of followed and it's kind of eddied round and like a Sebald text. Mm-hmm. But I was thinking of Las Meninas, the Velázquez painting, because looking at it in front of me, can I understand all the relations? If I had to kind of write down who was looking at who and who's where, and it's impossible almost to do it from memory. Well, I would find it hard. But that idea of the glimpse that you talked about, and I wonder I'm leading up to a question, is a glimpse all we're ever going to get? Is that it?
Well, I mean, I really don't know, but I think that a glimpse, I mean, Benjamin would say that's what it was, and so would Adorno, that it's a glimpse, it's a flash, it's a flame, you see it in a flicker. We have a moment of a glimpse. And on the announcement that I sent, the landscape, here it is, this landscape, I found this in a market in Italy, but what is really interesting about this, apart from the mechanism of it being a mirror, a duplicating machine, a photo, graph, but also that you can only get a partial view ever. And this partial view, there's also a really lovely reflection of a cloud in it that becomes the obscuring point in the middle of it. I had a colleague of mine at the RCA look at this, and they think this is from about 1910, which I think is a really interesting period anyway, but around the time that, you know, Benjamin was alive and writing at that point anyway, early in his career. Mm-hmm. And I think there is a... I think it only happens in flashes. What is it that we're talking about, you know, when you say it? And this is the mystery that drives you, I think, is sort of like, what is that it? What do I feel like there's something there that I'm only getting a tiny little fraction of a glimpse of? And every once in a while, I sort of feel like I'm overcome that I might get a bigger glimpse. I don't know if other people feel that. What do you think about the glimpse?
Well, that not being able to hold the whole thing in your head, because it requires you to be, especially being thinking visually, it requires you to be looking at it, and then you can kind of hold it for as long as it's there, and then when it's sort of gone, the cubist stuff, it's kind of hard to hold in your head, because when you see them, they're always more remarkable than you remember them being, and you remember them being fairly remarkable. Because there's always more detail and more things and more going on, and it's that kind of requiring looking to be a partner to thinking, and I suppose that's what and the glimpse is sort of what you notice, and it's that moment where you recognize that moment of recognition, but then you can't hold it, maybe.
Like the little animal, you said look for the eye, the first, second, third image. You see it, you look away, you stop seeing it. You have to look every time, find it anew.
I mean, that thing of that we just don't... I mean, it's also, like right now, every single person has got something going on in their head and their heart right here. I mean, this is pretty full. Like, you know, and I swear...
And I can tell you what it is.
Yeah, is it a deadline? No, but it's more, you know, and I bet you all have dreams, and I will never see them, and you'll never see mine. And so there's something that's also kind of, that we... secret away from each other in a way, and we just every once in a while get glimpses. And I think that you know, that the phone call when you went, I was just thinking of you, and you called, you know, or there's a certain kind of connections that you make that you wouldn't normally sort of make those kind of connections. And I think that there are moments, this is like the glimpse, but I think that we don't ever get a whole view. I think Google Earth is a perfect example of how we never get the whole. It's only, you know, a partial view, and actually what we think the Earth is probably exactly not what it is. And I think that I find it really hard to call myself an artist now, you know, in the world that we live in. And that has something to do, I think, with the fact that we, computers and technology, the way things are opening up, that sort of what happens in on computers, what's been made available and accessible through that. But also something of our of this thing about work, what we become through work, that through our work is a becoming as well. Mm-hmm. And I think that when we look at a painting, we become the painting, that the painting was always, was partly what the painting does was anticipating your view, was that poet, you know, the rose has the look of the flower that is always looked at. T.S. Eliot.
Right.
I think Lacan calls this the gaze. But I think there is a, I think that what it is that we see is really interesting. I'm really curious, are you a painter? That sounds like a painter.
No,
question.
Not really. No. I've been doing drawings lately, but that's kind of...
He is a bit of a painter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I don't want to hog other
but
people.
I want to say something because it's coming back to Lacan's seminar 11, where his moment of the sardine can, and it's a memory. He's young intellectual, out with the Breton fisherman, and Petit Louis says to him, see that sardine can in the sea? Looks over the boat. It's, you see it, but it doesn't see you. And they all laugh, young intellectual upstart. But being Jacques Lacan, he says, well, actually, it does see me. It looks at me. And then he starts to formulate his idea of being looked at in the world. But he's very close to Merleau-Ponty at this time, and is thinking about the spectacle, the world being a spectacle but not exhibitionistic.
Mm-hmm. I mean, and also Calvois, the biologist, yes. that he was looking, you know, close with at that point in time. Well, later he was, wasn't he? But this idea, I mean, I really, and Rossier's idea that the audience is not passive, that you're actually active, you just don't. You know, because you're not up acting and performing, you're actually in a very active state of engagement, and that we are participating in this exchange. So, and I really, really, you know, the emancipation of the spectator, he calls that. And I'm really interested in that. But also this thing of on YouTube, these YouTube communities where somebody gets on and they, you know, there's all sorts of different kinds, but they perform straight to camera. They perform straight to a screen. To no one but themselves, and with the hope of an audience of a million. Mm-hmm. And some of them do go, you know, some of these do go viral, so, you know, and they're really sort of quite astonishing, you know, when you think about that, when you are speaking into a flat surface with nobody there. So it really is a sense that the audience is very active, but their temporal logic is different than your own at that time.
Trish, can I ask you something about your talk? Mm-hmm. Because it was incredible, the kind of scope. But what you seemed to focus on was the family Penrose.
Or they came up.
Family Penrose.
Yeah.
And I was just wondering about that model, the family Penrose. Well, are they, the way that they exist, is that kind of, do they open themselves up to the world? Is it that they have some kind of glimpse, as Brian's talking about? What is it about the Penrose family that intrigues you?
I feel like I didn't find them, they found me or something when I was doing this, because I've been looking around at audio camouflage and thinking about how audio camouflage works, deception, that kind of thing, and that's where I came across the Shepherd's Tone, and the Shepherd's Tone cross-referenced into the Penrose Stairs. I thought, Penrose? I thought, is that the Penrose that was the art critic that was... And then it turned out it wasn't, it was another. This is the first time that I've talked about the Penroses, was this today. So I'm not too sure what it is. And that's also seeing likenesses, how we see likenesses. It's not that things are alike, but that we see likenesses. And I think family really brings it out. It's like, what, you know, oh, you look like your mother. Who's ever had that happen? Oh, you look like your father. You look like your brother. That there's a sense that you look like something, this making resemblances, that we make resemblances. It's that action that we make them. And this goes also to the like button on Facebook, you know, that algorithm that the more that you hit a like button, the more likes that will hit, you know. So it's like a popularity game, the like, you know, and Also, the Google search, the algorithms work that you have, the more you hit them, the more it grows, if you like, you know, exponentially it starts to sort of, so it has an algorithm at the heart of it, and I think there's something of the mathematics in it that I'm interested in. The Penroses, perhaps, but I don't know that much about them, except that I've made these funny connections today. I'm going to definitely explore
but
them.
But it was like a kind of feedback loop coming through, like the audio piece was a feedback, becomes a feedback loop, and there was lots of that going on in the talk.
Mm-hmm. The talk had the structure of a dream, and Freud calls it the dream work. And that's it, felt like working through it had the logic, the way that your logic you have when dreaming. It's not unusual when unusual things happen, but you know that it's not as it should be, it would happen normally. Mm-hmm. And that seemed to play out in the talk.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely, there's slippages in reasoning for sure that went on in that, and as I was moving along in them, I was thinking, oh, this is one, I thought it was one thing, but as I'm talking it out, it's another thing. Mm-hmm. This thing also, these kind of lectures that I do, I transcribe them, and it takes quite a long time to turn them into some reasonable papers that, you know, they can be reasoned out, but they actually don't work that way. It's really hard to get them to. I mean, I can switch in that way, but then it a tremendous amount of reason gets involved in that, and grammar, and you know, active voice, passive voice, first person, second, third person, da da da. And I don't, you know, it's not the writing isn't an experimental process for me. You know, it's sort of much more of a having to sort of sit down and write them out like that is very hard work. You know, I mean, this is hard work. I was so nervous doing this today, and it was partly the Penroses because I felt like I didn't really know that much about them, but they kept on coming up, but I couldn't avoid.
Were you worried there was a Penrose expert? A Penroseologist, is that in the audience?
Yeah, or no, I would hope so.
Or Penrose.
Yeah, or Penrose even. Yeah, if you're there.
Yeah, just to open up. Anybody?
Yes.
Anybody want to ask?
Yes.
Yeah, he's an exhibit quite dependent because Hofstadter is all about self-reference and complex systems, and stipulates that consciousness comes from the complexity of the pattern and nothing else. There's nothing innate in our brain cells which gives rise to consciousness. It's just that the pattern is really complex. And you can have consciousness made from tennis balls or chocolate pieces if there was a complex in the pattern. But Roger Penrose, the guy who Penrose said, he wrote a book called Shadows of the Mind, which says that there is an innate thing, a molecule inside, like our brain cells, which makes us conscious. But I kept expecting you to talk about Hofstadter when you were, because it was all sort of that sort of thing. You know?
Yeah, I mean, I read Gudel Escher Bach like years ago, and when I actually studied engineering in my misspent youth, and so it's come back to haunt me now. There's a lot of calculus and mechanical engineering is what I was involved in. When I was there, it was like such a big book to read, Gudel Escher Bach, it was sort of, you know. This whole idea, and this is also coming back to the Penrose, that was really surprising, was that he, because a lot of this leads to artificial intelligence. This artificial intelligence is there's such a huge, Google is dedicated to the AI project. In order to build the artificial intelligent machine, you need as much information as possible. You have to feed it into the algorithms. That's how you develop it. But Penrose, and I don't, as far as I understand, Penrose, the physicist, is alone in his kind of, you know, a lot of people don't share his view because it kind of doesn't flow with the artificial intelligence where Hofstadter does, because oranges can have a consciousness, it's to do with the complex patterning, exactly.
Does that throw it back onto camouflage, that idea of complex patterning is a kind of, that's as good a definition of camouflage?
Exactly.
I mean, that I'm making a kind of leap, because obviously a camouflage octopus isn't a kind of consciousness, or maybe it becomes that.
Well, I mean, this is, I'm so out of my depth talking about consciousness.
You're out of your depth, right?
I think the camouflage is really interesting because, one, it implicates us into the looking, being observed, and observing. So it shows up that complex relationship. I think its relationship to animals is profound. And I think that's something, the animating line, I think that's something that is thrilling and shocking at the same time about it, and also that it is to do with warfare. And so it works across so many different registers.
And it draws a straight line back down to mimesis.
Yeah.
To Plato, and it goes right back to the beginning of thinking about.
Well, Plato's thing about the mimesis got picked up and sort of became about representation.
Yeah.
And I think that what I was maybe looking at was slightly different. It was more about replication than representation. But Plato did warn about mimesis.
Yeah.
He did give a warning to humanity, sort of saying, ban the poets, because they can make it up and they can make you believe. And that's dangerous, because they can be something that they're not. And so that is ambiguous. And so that thing about stealth and uncertainty and paranoia, for example, that you're being watched, that feeling of, anybody ever been paranoid here? Yeah. That feeling, of
just
being...
It's everyone, they're just not admitting it.
Yeah, no, good. I mean, I think that this is sort of also, I have to say, that gives you the real rub for being an artist and being, I think that it is, you know, as artists, I don't really like to pathologize things, you know. Things that would be pathologized as madness, actually in art, is very much the material and the being that we are. So I don't think it's, it's interesting that they become pathologized, like, she was mad, she jumped out of the window, he cut off his ear, and they pathologize this kind of thing. But I actually sort of think as artists that it's not a pathology. Or, so I think that that thing of being paranoid that you might be watched or your thoughts might be seen, is very much a part of what Plato was also warning against, that there's a kind of uncertainty about where your position is in the world or where other positions are in relation to that.
Mm-hmm. And there's also the problem in certain kinds of camouflage, like the stick insect, being too good at it. Mm-hmm. So it simply looks like a stick.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, if it's a stick, it's not going to get shagged when it meets another stick insect. It's not going to meet another stick insect.
It's too
so
sticky.
Busy being a stick. A dead stick.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that's one of the problems for too effective.
Abby.
Too effective.
I guess, thank you very much. That was really great. I really enjoyed that. And I guess I was thinking about your interest in camouflage, and then I picked up on your statement where you said that you find it really hard to call yourself an artist in the world at that moment. I just wondered if you could kind of go into your thinking about that statement, behind the statement, a little more.
Yeah, I mean, that I feel like, I'm coming out, I'm not an artist no more. I think that has to do with, that thing has to do a lot more with the late capitalism in the worker, what our identities are. And so I think by not situating myself in that way, I have more freedom. Freedom is a completely false god, but it's something that allows me a sense of control over what I'm doing. So it's partly to do with that, but at the same, and I think also this feeling that this fascination with mathematics, because I'm currently sort of working on making some of the sounds you heard I made myself. Made an analog synthesizer and produced those. And I'm really find that I'm much more, tinkering and in my studio doing that and taking and revisiting calculus, which is, I don't really sort of, it doesn't feel as visual anymore. So I think that part of it is my kind of, I'm losing my sight or something. And so it's also acknowledging that part of myself. But underneath it, I love coming through the border agency and saying I'm an artist. I love it, it's like then that's when I really whip it out, or going to a cocktail party, and you can become like the token artist, and it's just like, oh, so what do you do, I'm an insurance salesman, oh, I'm an artist. So, so I guess in a way I play on it. I play with it like an actor plays with a role, I think. But actually inhabiting the role, I'm so involved in education right now, and that's a different kind of practice. And I really believe in public education. And I'm in staying in, I'm doing the big fight right now for education, for arts and humanities. That's what I'm doing. That's why I'm working in education, and total respect for everybody that's still in here fighting. To get and make sure that art students are funded to be able to go, those kind of things. So right now while I do that, you know, I'm an anarchist educationalist is what my job title is now. I might be able to I hope come back to be able to call myself an artist.
Stephen today talked about artist statements. Don't look so embarrassed. And how whenever he wrote an artist statement or read an artist statement, he felt like he had to be that artist. Mm-hmm. That was producing the artist. That what he said about it, that it preceded.
That's interesting. Yeah, that thing of sort of authoring it and then you declare it, and it's a you know, often artists don't write about their work. They have other people write about their work. It's very commonplace in the
industry. The strongest relationship between sort of pre-artist statement, my work, and post-artist statement, and these different works, I found the conformity that I had to fit to this artist statement that was created from my work.
Mm-hmm.
It was really messing with my head up. So.
I mean, I think that messing up your head is like when you're experiencing this sort of state that I call a radical ambiguity. It's like, what do I name myself? Am I that person? Like, oh, maybe I script myself. Can I actually fake it? You know? And then the fake is really interesting in relation to the replicant and the copy. So that we're prone to it as artists, I think. We're really prone to it, and artist statements really bring that to the fore. So while you struggle with that, and I think that there's a feeling of collapsing identity when you have to write those things, even though it's the declaration of your identity, so it's paradoxical, which is some of the things that I was showing here. Oh, by the way, this is by Dario Villagarto, and we work together, we're collaborators in sort of music sound stuff that we do. And he put this together for me, because I've been working, preparing this since Jasper asked me to come and do this, and so I invited him to collaborate with me on this. So these are, obviously taken from representations of products, stains, and medical models. So there you can see the doubling and the staining. And using the mirroring, using actually the effect of the mirror and the double in order to sort of produce this work. So that's a gift. He said it was a gift to everybody that came today.
And it also stain. In the Lecon, the stain in the picture. In French, it's tache. But tache is also task. And you can hear it both ways, that the work is the task. The task is something you have to perform, isn't it? It's a demand. Something has to be filled. Fulfilled is not quite like work. But tache and tache, it's the same sound, but same meaning.
When you were talking about resemblance, I was thinking it's a resemblance. You're rebuilding something. When a resemblance is a rebuilding of, and there's lots of that. Anything with re in the front, it seems to be about and again.
Yeah, I mean replication, duplication, representation, semblance, reassembling. Those, and it's like you can kind of feel like you're caught in a hall of mirrors. One door leads to 1,000 other doors, and it's a sort of that can be quite confusing. And sort of what the touchstone is, I think that's the Benjamin glimpse, becomes like the touchstone in the moving phantasmagoria in a way.
It's now 6 o'clock. I think we probably have to.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, thank you, everybody.
Thank you.